I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, open up the Twitter or Facebook or pretty much any other social media platform, and you're going to be treated to an unfiltered flow of garbage posts and hate. There is disinformation about vaccines, public safety, immigration, the economy, folks who are LGBTQ+, and free speech. The big platforms have tried to moderate harmful content, but not only did it fail, but it seems to have fueled the extremist. Content moderation on social media has become one of the most daunting challenges of our time. Nowhere is the need for action more urgent than in the fight against terrorism, foreign and domestic. So why have the efforts to put guardrails against those hateful posts failed? And what are the consequences? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org. This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was about 1995 that I bought my first home computer. I wanted to go online. The internet was the big thing, was starting to happen, but it was very different back then. Not even web pages yet. It was all dial-up. There were services like America Online or Prodigy that you used to connect to other folks, and you interacted with them in chat rooms. I was excited, and I thought to be able to engage back and forth with others and discuss mature politics and issues of the day. But when I first logged on, I was so naive. All I saw was a lot of support for Ron Paul, and everyone else was shouted down and flamed with nasty name-calling. Since then, things have only gotten worse. Groups with a message of hate and extremism have used online platforms for spreading their hate and calls for violence. And now, decades later, we still don't understand why that is. Why are they so successful online, and what to do about that? Tamar Mitz, a professor at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, has been researching online extremism for years. Her new book is out today. It is Safe Havens for Hate: The Challenge of Moderating Online Extremism. And Tamar Mitz, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why is it that online platforms, whether it be social media or back in the day with America Online, seem to just really, the online extremism just took it like duck to water?
Yeah, that's such a good question, and actually what motivated me to write this book, to be honest. I think that we're seeing a complicated set of dynamics that are driven by a lot of different actors, and the outcome is what we see, which is a wide space online where a lot of actors that wish to promote harmful ideologies, hate against other people, institutions, and other related things, essentially use these spaces for their purposes. And like you described just now, I think that what we're seeing is these actors becoming more sophisticated as efforts to address that sort of harmful content evolve. And I think that one of the things that we are dealing with as in societies, especially democratic societies, is how to balance our desire for free speech, free expression, with the regulation of harm. And I think this is something that I'm tackling in this book, and I'm happy to talk about it today.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed right away online with these groups is that going online kind of negated geography. If I had a small group in my city and a small group in another city, and they really didn't have a critical mass of individuals, but when they go online, they're able to work together in mass and have a stronger impact than they were before if they were had to interact in person.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something we've seen both in the US context as well as many other countries, is this ability to connect and coordinate, which we could think of as something really fantastic about the internet. And I think, you know, all of us are excited that we could connect all these different ways. What it has enabled these smaller and fringe organizations is to do the same and not only be able to connect, like you say, disparate geographic communities, but also amplify their message in a way that people who may have never stumbled upon what they're promoting are now more likely to see it and perhaps be attracted to it.
And so we've seen this, in your research, we can see how the game continues to change. There was initially a lot of concern about how Islamic radicalization was being used online. Not a lot of concern about domestic terrorism, but that seems to be the big concern right now. Is that right?
Yeah, what we're seeing now is something that to me is honestly somewhat puzzling. If you look at the trends in our efforts to address harmful content online, you would see these trends where the larger and more famous social media sites, like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and what is now X and YouTube and other platforms, are really those that are leading the efforts to address hate and extremism online. And the smaller spaces are more lenient, and that's something I describe also in the book. But what we're seeing these days, which is, I would say, the new set of trends and movements in this space of online extremism, is that the largest platforms are now rolling back their efforts to address this content. So what you are seeing, and this is something we've seen mostly in the past couple years, especially since Twitter became X and everything that followed. Is that those tactics and strategies that hateful actors have been employing to evade content moderation on the larger sites kind of are changing now because they have more and more spaces to be, more vocal, reach larger audiences. So in some ways, we're actually reversing the trends that I describe in a lot of my research, which is increasing efforts to regulate content. We see something slightly different these days. And I think I would say this is definitely a concerning trend.
Right. So Facebook or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, these are big corporations. They're worth a lot of money. They want to protect themselves from becoming a cesspool of online hate. And so it was in their best interest to try to keep it off the platform. They want it to be family friendly. They wanted people to use it, to come onto their platform and be entertained, to be informed. Find out about friends and family, all sorts of really wholesome ideas, but they lost control of it. It does seem now that you go online and you wonder, like, why did I do that? Why am I looking at Twitter now, or going online to Facebook, and all I'm seeing is things that are just making me very uncomfortable, if not angry, because I don't agree with any of this, and I feel overwhelmed. I mean, so it seems why the economy, the economics of running a massive social media platform just doesn't seem like it makes sense any. It doesn't make sense to me.
I completely agree. Sometimes I describe logging into a platform as like opening the door to a room where everybody yells at each other and is really nasty and angry. And so I want to shut the door and run away sometimes. But I think that you're right. There's really deep questions to ask about why this is the case. Like you say, we could imagine humans connecting online being something that is really beautiful, really inspiring, fostering creativity and whatnot. But we're seeing something opposite. And I think that this is obviously a very complicated answer, but I want to highlight a few points. First, what we've seen with the development of these big tech platforms is that the desire to maximize user engagement has led to the development of products that, amplify the content that people are engaging with the most.
Right, the
And that's
algorithm, giving people more of what they
yeah.
want.
Exactly. And turns out that research after research, we find that what people kind of like is outrageous content, things that make you angry and frustrated. That actually creates the most engagement. And from economic perspective, if the goal is to maximize engagement, then these algorithms are doing precisely that. So that's one reason
Right, so
why
I'm going to
this.
take a break here. We'll follow up
Sure.
on that after this 1 minute break, and our phone lines are open. Have you had enough with social media, with the online hate and extremism? There are violent groups on there that are using these the algorithms and these platforms to get to you and to get to others, and it's tearing America apart. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin. Davies Tamar Mitz is the author of the new book, Safe Havens for Hate, The Challenge of Moderating Online Extremism. And Tamar, I interrupted you. You were talking about, you know, why is it so hard to moderate these groups?
Yeah, right. So I mentioned the role of algorithms and maximizing engagement. But the other part that I think is slightly less understood, and I think even more interesting, is how these same systems are being misused. So actors who want to propagate a message, you know, it can be non-state actors, hate groups, but it can also be state actors that want to influence public opinion in another country. What we've seen in the past few years is this increase in the sophistication of tactics to reach people, you know, the average citizen in the US and in other countries, in a way that would attract their attention and get them engaged. So I think the outcome of these dynamics, both the algorithms and the decisions of platforms into what content to amplify, and then also the actors that are using these systems to push out a particular message, is what results in the current state of discourse on these platforms, which, as I agree with you completely, it tends to be very toxic, hateful, and sometimes misleading as well.
Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. I want to talk about the online platforms, social media. What do you see? How are you interacting with that? And we have Billy on the phones. And Billy, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me. This is a really pertinent topic, and it's something that's affecting me profoundly right now, and it's really frustrating. But I want to take a step back and talk about the news outlets that we get our information from, and how, you know, for the last 20 years, 30 years or so, people are watching completely different movies depending on the channel that they tune into, and the narratives are being framed by these respective media outlets, even if they settle lawsuits for disseminating, you know, false information, that people still tune into them, and other people tune into other opposite viewpoints, and they both like confirm our confirmation. I mean, they both reinforce our confirmation biases. So we become we just believe this stuff because that's what we're watching and that's where we want to go for our information. And, you know, more fact-checking, lots more fact-checking, and open-mindedness to explore other sources is imperative and critical, in my opinion. So, anyway.
All right. Well, Billy, thank you for the call. And so, Tamar Mitz, your reaction to Billy's observations?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that polarization of discourse, it's not something that we've seen, are seeing only online on social platforms. We also see this in the media, and I completely agree that if you take a more systematic look at how the same news stories are being framed by different media outlets, you will see very different versions day after day of the same events. And I think that this is, you know, it speaks really deeply to the kind of research I'm doing for the book, because even things like what is harmful content, what is misinformation, you know, what should we censor, what should we keep online, what is free speech, all of these questions are things that are becoming deeply politicized in a world that I personally think they shouldn't be. There should be certain categories that we all agree are beyond pale. We should not include or discuss them. But I think we are currently, unfortunately, in a context that has been for a long time and doesn't seem to go away at the moment, which is we are struggling to look across the political aisle, and as a result, we have different views on these issues that are harder to engage both online, offline, and I know sometimes it's within families, sometimes it's between friends, between communities, and I think that's one of the things that are the most challenging for our democracy.
Now, we know the problem that extremist groups use social media to spread their message. They have a front face to that messaging to the public, where they try to recruit middle class America to their ideology, or they try to recruit people who are disgruntled and had grievance ridden to their cause. And they also have an inward face where they're trying to enforce their purity of their cause. That's happening. The issue has been, why have these major platforms that are worth billions and billions of dollars and have, you know, created this whole new oligarchy in America, why have they been unable to police these voices and keep them, out of, to say, this is not acceptable. We have a term of use. If you have a call for violence, if you're spreading disinformation, we should be able to take you off this platform because we own it and it is a private company. It is not a public utility. So why has that failed?
Yeah, this is really the question for me. And when I started the research for this project, I was really puzzled why all these resources, billions of dollars, really going into these efforts that we also call trust and safety efforts in more tech lingo, are not successful. And one of the reasons I believe what is driving this is that we tend to think of this problem as kind of a platform by platform problem. So let's say we find a hate group or massive amounts of misinformation on Facebook, then we call on Facebook to do more. We find it's on YouTube, we call on YouTube to do more, and so on and so forth. But the phenomena that we are seeing on the other side of it, which is the actors who propagate all this information, they are deliberately working between platforms and around platforms and adapting to these different rules in the broader ecosystem. And our current solutions in the way we are thinking about the problem are just not addressing that kind of in between the cracks problem. And add to this what you mentioned about how these platforms are private companies. They can decide how to moderate content in their spaces as they wish, as a result of Section 230. So we have this kind of like inefficient system where incentives are not aligned in a way that could make our public discourse online healthy and productive. So this is something that I'm tackling in the book to really describe how this actually works and why this happens. But that would be my main answer to that question, is this inconsistency in addressing harmful content online.
Let's go to Gail on the phones, and our number is 833-877-8255 if you want to join the conversation. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi. Just yesterday on a podcast, I heard about how during the Biden administration, when Congress was talking about, discussing funds for Ukraine, that there was a social media post that said Zelensky had spent all this huge money on a yacht. And it got repeated. And the social media, whatever you call it, that where it came from, even had the word in the name of it, American something. And it turned out that it was from Russia. And I'm like, when I hear stuff like that, I just feel like we're doomed, that we can't trust anything. And I'm just, is there any way that are any of these internet platforms looking to see where this content is coming from and flagging it, that it's not from the U.S., that it's from another country, even though it has American in the title?
All right, Gail, thank you for that call. That definitely seems like a foreign interference in the United States. Russia would be deeply invested in trying to weaken public support for Ukraine, and it seems like they have been successful in that effort. So, but the question that Gail has is, why can't we prevent foreign actors, foreign nation states, from interfering with our national consumption of social media?
Thank you, Gail. This is such a really important question, and I think also shows us where we're going. So this episode and many others point to a concerning trend that has to do with new technologies we have today, such as generative AI, that and other tools that allow creating content that seems very, very authentic to the natural eye, let's say, of people in the U.S., content targeting the U.S. by actors like Russia. And if you look at how Russian operatives actually do this sort of propaganda campaigns, you would see that they do very deep research into our communities, our local communities even, and understanding not only the kind of issues that people care about, but also the kind of language that they use. And then they use AI systems to mimic that sort of discourse, to make it seem very authentic, like it's coming from, you know, people like you and me right here in the US. And then that is really has an agenda, not just to share information, but to share information that could be either false or misleading to shape public opinion. And Russia has been doing this not only in the US, but also in Europe since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. So what you're seeing here is this really fascinating dynamic of geopolitical interests into shaping public opinion of another country, and then using the tools of social media platforms and content creation to make information look so believable. And I think as citizens, we really need to be aware of those sort of strategies to be more resilient to them. But I just could not underscore enough how important this example is, because we are seeing this over and over again.
So Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist and personality, I've heard him say this, that AI is getting so good, disinformation is getting so, you know, filled through these social media channels that people are just going to give up on them. They're going to realize, I can't believe anything on Twitter. I can't believe anything on Facebook, not even something that says it's from a friend of mine. That people are just going to walk away from it. And so, and then people will, to get their information, they're going to turn towards trusted sources. Hopefully that includes public radio. You know, I mean, I've been, you know, involved in media in San Antonio for 40 years. And so people know who I am, and they, you know, I'm not an AI individual, and that's going to be more important in the future.
Yeah, I actually agree with this very much. I think that we do reach a point where people are starting to question everything and kind of, you know, you kind of ask yourself, like, okay, so I see something, how do I know this actually happened? And I think that the role of trusted sources, journalists that are well known and follow the standard, you know, high quality journalism is really what can save us from this information cascade, or maybe I should say disinformation cascade. But yeah, I just agree with you that I think this is something that we do need more, and if in fact, more than ever.
And this is my theory, that every time there is a breakthrough in mass communication, it often triggers a significant social upheaval. Going back to you know, the printing press and the movable type in the 15th century that brought about, you know, the Protestant Reformation, the telegraph, you know, revolutionized news distribution, but it also was incredible in spreading misinformation throughout the South leading up to the American Civil War. We had radio played a key role in spreading Nazi propaganda throughout Germany, fueling anti-Semitism. We had that also in the United States with radio, with Father Coughlin. And so I think whenever you have a major new form of media, you have this type of thing follows it, a disruption in the social fabric.
Yeah, I think this is really insightful point, kind of comparing and contrasting what we're seeing now with what we've seen before. I think the question I would have is really, how did we deal and adapt historically so that our social cohesion remains stable? And what we are seeing, at least in the discussions today, is this greater discourse on regulation and the need to do more.
I think we leaned more into gatekeepers. We looked for trusted people to make sure that we were getting good information. So we went into the 20th century television age, and we put people in place. And they were white men, and they had their biases, but that's where we ended up with, you know, more closely regulated news and information. But anyway, we got to take a break here. We're going to get back to talking about your book and not my theories. Sorry about that. Which is Safe Havens for Hate, The Challenge of Moderating Online Extremism. Our phone lines are open. Bianca, I'll get you on the air when we come back from the break. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. When you go online, go on social media, prepare yourself for a load of disinformation about public safety, immigration, the economy, folks who are LGBTQ+, vaccines, and also free speech. One of the things they spread disinformation about is about free speech quite frequently. We're joined by Tamar Mitz. Her new book is Safe Havens for Hate, The Challenge of Moderating Online Extremism. We know it. We've lived it. We're trying to figure out how do we move forward. How do we save democracy? It's a challenge. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Bianca. And Bianca, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering, what social factors do y'all think make people more susceptible to this extremism online?
Well, thank you so much, Bianca, for that question. And Tamar?
Yeah, thanks, Bianca. I think that's a really good question. We have some research to already kind of know some things. So obviously, we can't predict how anyone's life will evolve. But especially when you look at kind of who engages online or who is most likely to be attracted to the propaganda that these actors are creating online, it seems to be people who already have other reasons that kind of make them interested in it. So we don't have very strong evidence suggesting that like anyone who just stumbled upon a propaganda piece by a hate group would suddenly become, you know, so interested in it. That's not what the research seems to suggest. What we find more evidence for is people who are already kind of inclined to adopt maybe conspiratorial sort of worldviews or frustrated from something that that experience in their life that could give them grievance towards institutions, towards other people in society. Those are the kind of people that we see more likely to engage with those propaganda campaigns. And once that process starts, then we know a lot more about the trajectories. That often tends to be kind of liking, engaging, reading, you know, getting closer to communities that are promoting these ideas online, and then becoming more active in also vocalizing the same sort of messaging and, you know, and beyond. So, yeah, so I would say that this is usually what we see, but of course, there is variation across people and ideologies.
So do you think, like during the COVID pandemic, we had an explosion of disinformation online? We had a lot of people who lost their jobs or their businesses. It was a huge disruption to our entire society and economy. And people were spreading disinformation about the vaccines and also about the origin of the virus. People were home. They were alone. They were scared. Is that a perfect storm for spreading this kind of stuff?
Yeah, that would be exactly the words I would use. What we saw in COVID was really an extraordinary explosion of the same dynamics we've seen in other years before. I think a big part of it was people being more alone, people looking for information online. And when there is greater uncertainty, we tend to become more vulnerable to mis and disinformation campaigns. So I think this was really a perfect storm that a lot of these dynamics that we've been studying for years have been just really amplified and came out in such force that, had a lot of grave consequences.
And then once they get into one conspiracy, then it doesn't take a lot of effort to get into the next one. Yep. Now you think the moon landing was faked or, you know, all these other things. They, you know, 9/11 was an inside job, and the world is now flat. All these things are one after the other. The dominoes fall.
Yeah, the things start to kind of make sense, quote unquote. I think once you begin surrounding yourself with that sort of way of thinking and not verifying or, you know, being critical in the way you consume information and kind of thinking where this is coming from, etc. But yeah, I go back to trusted sources as this really important medicine that we can have for disinformation.
Let's go to another caller. And our number is 833-877-8255 for you to join our conversation, like Raymond. And Raymond, you're on the air with Tamar Mitz.
Hi. So my comment was going to be about your comment on Neil Tyson Degrassi, of how he said that social media or AI would probably collapse in the future because people could not trust it anymore. But that's going with the assumption that the population or the people have the critical thinking skills to realize that the information is not right or is incorrect or that it's propaganda and that it cannot be trusted. Because as it is right now, it appears half of the population right now does not appear to have the critical thinking skills to realize that they are being fooled.
All right. Well, Raymond, thank you for the call. So how many people, what percentage of the masses do you need to capture in online in order to really have your presence felt? I mean, like if according to the caller, Raymond saying, well, most people don't have the critical thinking skills. I disagree with that. I have high faith in humanity. But I think that, that there are a number of people that if you just reach enough of them, suddenly things go off the rails. About how many do you need? What percentage?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think that obviously one particular number is hard to give, but if you look at the kind of the online space and where these actors who want to have this real world impact operate, you would see that they always become attracted or move into the largest platform they can. And this is precisely because, you want to maximize impact, you want to maximize eyes on your ideas, then you would go to the largest spaces. I think that what we've seen, though, is that these larger spaces, at least until recently, have been really good or relatively good at clamping down on some of that content. So therefore, these actors are trying to get to the same sort of mass public through other means. And I think that those other means are really where things get tricky. So it's one thing to look at a piece of information and, apply your critical thinking skills and see that this is just like, suspicious or sus, as my kids say. But I think that it's a very different story when the same sort of message is cloaked in something that looks authentic. And I think that this is where we need to invest the most efforts, is to really understand the landscape, understand how content is being created, being disseminated. And I really do think that the public has the full capacity to have apply those critical thinking skills. But sometimes these technologies evolve so quickly that we need to kind of keep.
And people are being manipulated, they're not being told the full story. During the Palisades fire in Los Angeles, I saw a lot of right-wing media criticizing the mayor for being out of the country when that, disaster happened. But then they don't also bring up, Ted Cruz went to, Cancun when Texas froze, or when Hurricane Beryl hit Houston, Governor Greg Abbott was in China, these things happen all the time. But they're only telling you one part of the story, and they're getting you all worked up into a lather without you being fully informed.
Yeah, and I think this is definitely a tactic that seems to be working. Going back to this idea of outrage and making people angry, that mobilizes, that makes people more likely to do something, even if doing something would be to hit share on a post that will get more eyes on it. And I think that this is something that we unfortunately are seeing a lot in the online space these days.
Let's go to a voicemail that we got.
My name is Brad, and I'm calling from Cibolo. I think the internet had a lot of potential and promise and enthusiasm as a means of disseminating information, but the fact that it is pretty much every man for himself and the wild, wild west in terms of accountability or verified information, that has left us vulnerable. That I remember the Supreme Court case where they said basically the antidote to bad speech is not censorship, but good speech. If it's false speech, the antidote to it is true speech. And maybe if the internet providers could say statements made in this essay or document are contradicted by another essay or another research study, what you can read if you click here. The problem is, of course, everything is copyrighted and not everybody wants to share stuff. There are firewalls and stuff that the truth can't get publicity because you have to pay to get it. It seems that all the disinformation is free. It's kind of ironic how that works. Thanks, and I look forward to hearing this topic discussed at greater length.
All right, so we're short on time. We'll get more into this voicemail on the back end of this spot. We're going to get to this break, but Tamar, you know, talking about how the solution had been, you said, well, the solution for bad speech is more speech and more dialogue and more information. It just seems like only certain things are being elevated and being amplified in this space, and that seems to be the problem.
Yeah, like we are living in a world where we have so much information, none of us can actually see
it. It's the tyranny of choice. You know, when you go into the Baskin Robbins and you end up going with chocolate or vanilla because, you know, you can only handle so much.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think this multitude of information is really part of the problem here. This, how do we prioritize which type of content and how to make sure it's fair and balanced?
And, you know, and if you are being able to have enough opportunities to provide real free speech, I really want to talk about free speech and how there is a lot of disinformation about free speech, particularly from these activist extremist groups. We're going to do that. And our phone lines are open if you want to join the conversation. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about why social media platforms have become safe havens for hate. That's the title of the new book, comes out today by Tamar Mitz, Safe Havens for Hate, The Challenge of Moderating Online Extremism. So Tamar, these groups would like to say they trumpet free speech. We need free speech, and any efforts to censor them, that's not even the right word, But to moderate them on these platforms, they claim is somehow a violation of their right. So are they violating their rights to free speech as we know it in the United States?
Yes. So this is really the core of the political debate, really, on this, because we have the free speech laws that designate what is considered illegal content and what is not. But this is not where the debate really is. The debate that especially is promoted by these actors is really about the content restrictions that they are facing as a result of violating platform rules for engaging in harmful activity online. And kind of who gets to decide what that is. And oftentimes we hear this as a simplistic sort of debate between free speech and censorship. But the reality is that they are essentially violating rules that platforms have decided that are violating their terms of service.
Well, if I ran a restaurant and I said, no shoes, no shirt, no service. You know, these are my rules. Okay, don't come in here and eat in my restaurant. Or if I have a dress code, if it's a fancy restaurant, I have a right to be able to say this, right, and enforce it. If I'm going to run a platform, a social media platform that I've invested billions of dollars in, I should be able to say, I don't want people on here spreading pornography or hate or calls to violence.
Yeah, and that's actually their legal right. So this is why I think this sort of discourse around, you know, whether they're being violated, free speech is just misplaced. Because if you look at the rules of these platforms, this is kind of the rules, like you say, like if you have a restaurant and you have the rules on what is allowed in your business or not, or your territory, and then this is what should be respected, then yeah, I think this is really what the debate should be about. And then if you take it a step up and ask, okay, so where do these rules come from? Where do these companies decide on what is allowed and not allowed? that's when you get the really interesting part of the story of like why some are more restrictive, some are less restrictive, and that then that how that shapes what these actors can or cannot do online.
And these actors are very good at gaming the system, whether to use code words or phrases. And we've even seen that from President Donald Trump before he was elected, using social media to issue vague threats. And some other people, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a member of Congress, she was banned from Twitter for a while because of her speech on, you know, and Trump was banned for his speech and claiming that the elections were fraudulent when they weren't. And they didn't do any good. They're still, you know, Trump got reelected. Marjorie Taylor Greene's still in office. These people, you profile somebody who was banned from one platform, a major platform, and he just goes to Gab or someplace else and does very well in this new world. They seem to be actually getting juice, being elevated by the fact that they were banned.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I have a chapter in the book that I looked at it really closely. I was really fascinated by what happens to people who get banned for violating these rules. And turns out it's super mobilizing. They become even more, motivated to push the cause. And I think this is really kind of puzzling. But if you think of living in an, you know, narrative and story that you believe that the world is against you, that these platforms are against you, then it's really easy to believe when you are targeted yourself for, you know, let's say you violated one of the company's rules, let's say again, hate speech. I had many cases of this that I studied. And then you move to another platform, let's say Gab, then you really see that how that really activates people. And I think that's so unfortunate because there could be a different way. There could be other ways to engage, even if we disagree. But I think that the issue has become so polarized that it's really difficult to have a constructive conversation around it these days, unfortunately.
So this has been something that's been talked about in Congress. It claims that these techno bros who run these platforms were actively conspiring with the Biden administration to prevent the posting about certain things. There was a claim that the Twitter papers were going to expose all this. It did not. That turned out not to be true. Was there an active conspiracy by these big platforms like Twitter and Facebook in order to silence conservative voices?
That's a very common narrative that is not supported by the data. What you do see, and this is just giving it a little bit broader perspective as well, is that oftentimes many governments will ask social media platforms to take content that violates what they in their own jurisdictions either seem as harmful, illegal. And many times companies would not comply. I mean, sometimes they will. That depends on their own free choice. So I think that what you've seen also in the US is that, yes, there used to be and still is requests to remove content that, you know, either illegal or harmful. And then companies decide what they want to do with this request. I think that, so I think this is kind of how to think about this. In terms of how much content is being removed and whether companies are biased against conservative voices, again, this is not something that the data is supporting. If you look at enforcement actions or removal of content or suspension of accounts, you see that it does vary by ideology across the spectrum. But there used to be times, especially around 2020, 2021, where all the upheaval happened around the previous election and January 6th, is that there were a lot of violation of platform rules around those events that tend to come from people who are more on the conservative side. So if you only look at that time period, yes, it does look like maybe they're censored more or their content being removed. But if you look at the full range of spectrum of these cases, you see that this is actually not the case.
Another caller, Barbara. And Barbara, you're on the air.
Just 2 points. One is I'm concerned that lies, misinformation, distortion of facts is considered free speech because that is not what free speech is. There should be a separation of the two to, you know, determine what free speech really is. And of course, that isn't lies and misinformation. And the second thing is, in Finland, which of course has a totally different school system than here, they're actually teaching children to be able to determine what is, you know, fact, what is fiction, where they are being manipulated, and how to navigate social media so they're not caught up in the lies and misinformation that's so prevalent in this country.
Well, Barbara, thank you for the call. But telling lies is protected free speech. It's not just something that's limited to telling the truth. And so, you know, who gets to say what's a lie and what's the truth? And that's probably the next chapter that you need to write in your book, Tamar, is that how, when you write about in your book about how people get around these restrictions and moderations, how they get around AI, you know, moderating what they're doing, and they're using certain filters and ways to trick AI in order to. I'm thinking like that information is probably going to be very useful for people who want to spread information about protests against the current administration or things that are happening in the future. They're not extremist resistance, you know, extremist groups. There are people who may be fighting for democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when I was discussing this book with colleagues who study more authoritarian countries, they said like, oh, wow, all these tactics are like what we would say like part of the literature that we call liberation technology. So, you know, all the things you would need to do to evade repression by an authoritarian government. And that's all completely true. And I think it's a little bit of a way to so it's a little funny to think about it in that way, but it's actually the truth is that it goes back to this point about who decides what is harmful. And in the book, I actually take a liberal approach to this question. I come to this as a researcher who studies a phenomenon, and I don't come from a normative point of view kind of to tell everybody what I think is allowed or not allowed, but actually study how different actors, governments, and tech platforms decide on their own what is that harmful content that they want to censor or remove. But you're completely right that the same sort of techniques to evade censorship in a more authoritarian context are very, very similar to those that.
And I'm starting to see complaints online of people saying, we put up a thing about a protest happening and it was taken down. They keep taking down our posts that are about how to resist what's happening. And they're claiming that they're the ones who are being silenced, the ones who say they want to fight for a democracy.
Yeah. Yeah. So you see, it's kind of like the question is who has the power to decide? And they are those who are deciding at the given moment in time. But I think that the bigger question here is how do we use these great technologies for the better and for the good? And I think that this is what should drive both content moderation decisions and for the good means in democratic context for the wealth, well-being and survival of democracy and democratic institutions.
Well, now that we're living in the upside down, it's difficult to gauge, you know, we who has the power, who is fighting and who is mobilizing and recruiting online for the greater good. I want to thank you, Tamar Mitz. Her new book is Safe Havens for Hate, the challenge of Moderating Online Extremism. Fun conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Technical support by Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, and Yvette Benavides. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.